Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Veronica Garibay and Phoebe Seaton, 2020 recipients of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about their work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the latest issues in immigration, from healthcare to detention centers. And we go back to the 70s. A new exhibit at Fresno State celebrates the 13-year run of a magazine for African Americans. You know Jet and Ebony, but have you heard of Grapevine? We'll talk to one of its founders. Plus, Yemeni immigrants and the United Farm Workers. How the death of one protester and Arab nationalism challenged the movement's mission. But first, San Joaquin Valley voters went to the polls this week. After the first results came through late Tuesday night, former police chief Jerry Dyer was ahead in the race for Fresno mayor. Here's what he told us at his watch party.
You know, I've met our fundraising goals. I've walked the neighborhoods consistently. I've done the things that I'm supposed to do as a mayoral candidate. I told my wife on the way over here, I don't know anything else I could have done to improve my chances of winning.
Dyer was the city's police chief for nearly 20 years, but this is his first bid for public office. His opponent, Andrew Janz, is a prosecutor who challenged Congressman Devin Nunes in the 2018 election. Dyer said he was cautiously optimistic about becoming the city's next mayor. One of his former employees was more certain.
I'm over the moon. Yes, I have no doubt that he will be our next mayor.
That was Marilyn Karstead, a retired community service officer with the Fresno Police. Over at the watch party for progressive council candidates, 18-year-old Kelly Anderson had a different reaction.
I'm pretty disappointed because it's just sticking with the status quo. There's no change happening. You're not going to better Fresno because you haven't bettered Fresno.
But Anderson was also rooting for Tyler Maxwell, and early results put him in the lead for Fresno City Council District 4. Maxwell said if he wins, the council will better reflect the values and hardships that Fresnans experience.
You know, these are city council members that have gone through, you know, poverty or homelessness or substance abuse. And so I think it's going to be a city council that really reflects the majority of the city and the struggles they've gone through and are really able to reach out and empathize and sympathize with those folks and really help reach out to their core issues.
Since Tuesday, the unofficial voting results have shifted slightly, and mail-in ballots are still being counted. Results won't be official until 30 days after the election. To avoid a runoff in November, the winning candidate for mayor and council races must get over 50% of the vote. So instead of giving you numbers that will likely change over the next few days, we encourage you to check out our website, kvpr.org, where you'll find links to county and state election results so far. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. California's primary election is over, but the debate over how to address the problems facing the Valley endure. One of the most complex and entrenched of those issues is immigration. To find out more, I spoke with New York Times national immigration reporter Miriam Jordan and Fresno Bee reporter Crescencio Rodriguez Delgado. There is so much happening related to immigration right now. It's dizzying. I mean, even preparing for this conversation, I'm reading through the headlines and there's everything from the sanctuary city's grant fight to the legal back and forth on the stay in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, all happening while there's these continued efforts to halt the use of military funding for border wall construction. It's a lot. And those are just some of the legal battles. There are countless stories on the ground about how people are being impacted. So I'd like to start by having each of you weigh in on what you see as the stories we need to be paying attention to moving forward. Miriam, let's go ahead and start with you.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that the subject du jour is a coronavirus, actually, in terms of, you know, what's happening in the country and what concerns the country at a, you know, national level. And I'm very curious to see what the intersection will be between this virus and immigration. And by that, I mean that this administration has rolled out a number of policies that intimidate immigrants and might lead them to refrain from seeking medical care if they need it or if they have flu-like symptoms.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. Yeah, Crescencia, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned a lot of important issues. And like you said, there's so many issues within the topic of immigration. But I think also, I mean, healthcare, absolutely. I mean, that is one of the most important issues, especially for elderly immigrants who just don't have access. And so I think when you're talking about locally, another issue really is, I think it's income. You have a lot of families who are struggling to get by, at the same time having to face these pressures about, am I going to be eligible for benefits? Am I going to be able to provide for my children, who sometimes might be citizens, but these parents are not? And so I think income and healthcare are absolutely two of the most crucial issues for immigrants here in the Valley.
Miriam, you did some extensive reporting on a private prison company's bid to convert two prison facilities in McFarland into federal immigration detention centers. Tell us a little bit about your reporting on that particular issue and what you know about where it stands today.
Right. So the issue here was that GEO, which is a very large and rich private prison operator, had been operating two state prisons in the heart of a farm working community in McFarland, California. And for the years that it had been doing this, it never was a concern, really, for the farm workers, many of whom are here without papers. As we know, the large share, probably the majority of farm workers are undocumented. Americans do not seem interested in doing work in the fields as they haven't been for many, many years now. So GEO is interested and, well, keen to convert these two prisons into immigrant detention facilities instead. And that's because the California governor had decided, with backing from the legislature, that private operators of prisons should not operate in the state as of January 1st, 2020. And since immigration is a federal issue, GEO and the federal government, and in this case, Immigration and Customs Enforcement specifically, tried to circumvent this decision by converting these two facilities into immigrant detention facilities rather than just facilities holding garden variety California prisoners. So suddenly this community that surrounds these two facilities has become very concerned that they themselves could end up behind bars in that facility. And so the prospect of having immigrant detention centers in the middle of this farm working community led the farm workers themselves to begin organizing and campaigning against it. And they went door to door canvassing, raised awareness of the issue, led a march, and ultimately the backdrop to this, aside from the fact that there were these two facilities that were going to be converted, is that there would be a decision that was quite fatal, one might say, that was going to take place several weeks ago now at the City Planning Commission meeting or hearing. And on that night, the Planning Commission voted in opposition to the conversion into immigration facilities. And now GEO has appealed that decision. So the work of the immigrants in the community was fruitful. The decision was in their favor, but this multi-billion dollar company has decided to appeal and take this to the actual city council itself. So we don't know yet when there will be another vote, but the story is not over.
And I would imagine the story is not contained to McFarland either.
Well, exactly. I mean, across the country, there are immigrant detention centers in areas that have large immigrant communities. In this case, what's somewhat unique is that population of undocumented immigrants, it's quite large, is just right there. I mean, in other parts of the country, like, for instance, GEO operates a facility in the high desert near Victorville in the town called Adelanto. Well, there's not really much agriculture there, as far as I know. So there wouldn't be as many field workers in the area. I mean, the economy there is very depressed, as it is generally. I mean, these Central Valley towns are very poor. As my colleague just mentioned, you know, the immigrants are poor, but they are working in the fields. They are harvesting the fruits and vegetables that we consume in this country. So the issue of immigrant detention is quite heated. But I would say that most of these facilities seem to be in more isolated locations, not in the middle of a town that is so rich in agriculture and where so many workers themselves live.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We've been hearing from Miriam Jordan, national immigration correspondent for The New York Times. I'd like to shift the conversation back to you, Crescencio Rodriguez Delgado from the Fresno Bee. Now, when you were still a student studying journalism, you were very outspoken and vocal about your status as a dreamer. Now you are a working journalist at a time when we have a president who is calling journalists enemies of the people. I would just love to hear what you're experiencing given your status.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been a thought that I've had before. When the president started to kind of rail against journalists and calling journalists enemies of the people. But I think I started being comfortable with saying that I was an immigrant and that I was an undocumented immigrant in high school when I couldn't get an internship one time, one summer. I couldn't get an internship, and so I had to explain to my classmates why not. And it was because I didn't have a social security number. And so at that point, I mean, I thought it was very beneficial to my classmates to understand why I couldn't do something that they could, even though I had been told that I'd been qualified. And so since then, really, it was really just about being honest and saying, I can't do this because I'm an immigrant or because I'm undocumented. And so being a journalist is really about telling those stories that for some people might be uncomfortable. And even if there's people who say that you don't belong here, one, because you're a journalist, or one, because you're an immigrant, you really have to continue and just tell those honest stories. Because at the end of the day, you, as the journalist and as the immigrant, are the one experiencing both realities.
And it must impact the way you go about your work as a reporter, your personal experience.
I think it does. I mean, I think in the long run, it's benefited me because it's, and I'm sure that many journalists like myself who come from immigrant backgrounds would also say this as well. I think that it empowers us. It allows us to kind of look at stories differently. It allows us to look for different kinds of stories, understanding that there are multiple stories that can be told about certain topics from an immigrant perspective, but not just from an immigrant perspective. I think understanding that stories are complex. And so when you're going into some stories that are not necessarily related to immigration, you understand, okay, there might be other angles here. So you start to understand the complexity of things. And so that has really been beneficial.
So I couldn't agree more. There is so much complexity and nuance in any story we tell as journalists. But the immigration story is just particularly complicated. Miriam, I'd love to get your thoughts about just sort of the general nature of how we as the media have talked about immigration and how that influences the public's understanding of this incredibly complicated issue.
Yeah, I mean, I echo what my colleague said to the extent that, you know, what I think, you know, we try to do is to give a voice to people on the ground. And that and in our case, I mean, we're covering immigration. And, you know, I am so committed to getting out there in the field and talking to immigrants and telling their stories like I did when I went to McFarland. And I decided to build a story around one of these undocumented immigrants who had called McFarland home for 20 years and has two American-born children, one a straight-A student, the other this, like, hard worker who, you know, whenever he has, you know, time, is out there helping his parents, you know, make extra money by harvesting grapes or, you know, mowing lawns or whatever. So I think that what's difficult now is that a lot of the public chooses the media that they listen to based on their, you know, preconceived notions about immigration and other topic as well. So it's hard to reach the people who I think need to be enlightened or to see undocumented immigration and immigrants in a more nuanced fashion because, you know, I know that most readers of the New York Times tend to be, one, educated, and two, tend to be more tolerant and open. And so, you know, occasionally I'll get hate mail from someone who has read a story, not necessarily on the New York Times website, or has come to the website through Yahoo News or another vehicle and has very strong anti-immigrant views that, you know, I wish I could, you know, I could convince to stay with me and to keep reading stories, because I think that when we tell stories and we personalize an issue, it does change opinions, or it makes people see things in a different light, or it helps them see them in a more nuanced fashion. And so, I mean, that's one of my frustrations as I cover immigration. It's, you know, when you feel, you know, sometimes that you're like just preaching to the choir as opposed to getting people who have very strong views. I mean, people who are concerned about the changing demographics of the country, right? The country is less white. It's, you know, we are now in a majority minority state in California. I mean, those people, I think, you know, if we could only get them to not see this mass of undocumented immigrants, to see them as people, as individuals, as opposed to, you know, this kind of amorphous group that is, they believe, is mooching on this system, you know, that would be helpful to the national conversation and, you know, to people, how people relate to each other in general.
Sure. Crescencia, I see you nodding your head in agreement.
100%. I mean, everything she said is absolutely, it's correct. There is a ton of disconnect, I think, not just in the Valley, but I would be safe to assume in the world when it comes to understanding why people move and why they have to call another place home. Locally, I mean, in the Valley, there is disconnect both among immigrants from information sources, but also among people who are not immigrants who have trouble understanding the immigrant experience, or that their neighbor might be an immigrant and why they're an immigrant. And as my colleague was saying, there are these preconceived notions that you go in a conversation to where you might be thinking that if your neighbor is an immigrant, you're already starting to believe things that might not be true about your neighbor. You know, in some reporting that I've done, I've had the chance to interview immigrants who live in these Central Valley towns and are simply trying to tell their government, their local government or their state government, we would like clean air, we would like clean water. These are just people trying to survive. And so at the end of the day, whatever your opinion might be about immigration or about undocumented immigrants in this country, I think that we would all be well served by having neighbors who are healthy and by having better information sources. Because I think that another problem with, you know, with this with the struggles of journalism right now is that we just don't have the reporters that we need to go out there and tell these stories. And you know, we've been getting some great reporting from the Desert Sun with these developments in McFarland and with the Geo Group. You know, that is absolutely crucial information for people who are just not aware of that situation. And so there's a lot of disconnect, and I think it has to do a lot with just the struggles of journalism. And also, we are limiting the sources that people can go to for news. And what's left is very opinionated, very partisan. And that really does not help to bridge these divides. And so I think that it's very detrimental to the advancement, I think, of us as a Valley and also as communities.
Final question that I will offer up to both of you. What have you learned? What has been the biggest surprise to you in the work that you've done covering immigration and immigration-related stories? Miriam, we'll start with you.
Well, I don't know if this is so surprising, but it's certainly disappointing that, you know, the last time that we actually had a full-fledged immigration reform bill was when Ronald Reagan was president. You know, all these years later, of course, we have an undocumented population that is larger than when that amnesty occurred. And of course, amnesty is considered, you know, kind of a dirty word nowadays. But what I'm speaking of is just like Congress actually building bridges and being able to, you know, sit down and hammer out some kind of a solution that is to the satisfaction of both sides, Republicans and Democrats, because, you know, we are now in a full employment economy for all intents and purposes, and we have a shortage of labor, and we're still talking about deporting people left and right, rather than looking for solutions, at least for those who have been here, you know, for perhaps decades, right? Maybe they arrived in 1986 and didn't qualify for that program. But, you know, we have a whole core cohort of American-born children of an undocumented immigrant. We have so many, 800,000 documented young adults. And we're still at a standstill, right? And that's just not for the greater good of the country. I mean, it has families in limbo, both psychologically and kind of economically frozen. And for the good of the country, I think, you know, this issue needs to be addressed. And it just can't be that it's impossible for adults in the room to come to some consensus.
I think in general, what I've learned being a reporter and also being an immigrant, I think, is how to truly, truly tell stories that are honest. Because coming from an immigrant background, one would assume that it's so easy for me to just go and cover an immigration story. But really, no, because I think immigrant stories are all a little different. And so my family story is much different than the family that's down the street. And so I really have to approach their story with an open mind. And that's what I try to do as a reporter. I think that I've learned so many stories over the years as a reporter, when I was a student and also now as a professional journalist with the Bee, where families are eager to tell their stories. You know, that is something that I was surprised, because, you know, you think that you go in and you shy away from asking questions that you think might be personal, but they really want to tell their story. And they're not all the same, you know, in many ways they're not the same. And so that's one thing that I've learned, is that no immigrant story is the same. And so you really have to go out there and just talk to people.
Well, I thank you both for your thoughts today and for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
The United Farm Workers Movement easily brings to mind Cesar Chavez and Mexican laborers. And if you know your history really well, maybe Larry Itliong and Filipino farm workers. But you probably don't know there's another community in the Central Valley that was deeply engaged in the movement. Writer Nima Alamri has been researching the history of Yemeni farm workers as part of her doctoral dissertation at UC Merced. News director Alice Daniel spoke with her about her recent article in the online journal Boom California.
Welcome to the show, Nima. In your article, you mention attending a UFW event a few years back, and you were approached by a woman who had a confused look on her face as if to say, "What does a Muslim Arab American have to do with the UFW?" And it turns out a lot. Your research into the history of the Yemeni involvement in the UFW started with your father's stories. Tell us about that in the context of why Yemenis were coming to the Central Valley in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, so my research and interest in the history of Yemenis in the UFW stemmed from my own father's experiences. So my father immigrated to the U.S. in 1975. He actually arrived first in Dearborn, Michigan, where there was a really large Yemeni community, and till this day has the largest, the most concentrated Yemeni community in the United States. But when he arrived in Michigan, where many Yemenis were working in the auto industry, a lot of his friends told him, you know, actually, if you want to find the real jobs, go to California, go to the Central Valley, because that's where agribusiness was booming in the 1970s. And so my father listened to the advice of his friends and family and left Dearborn, Michigan to the Central Valley and arrived in Poplar, California. And at the time, I think growers were particularly interested in hiring Yemenis for several reasons. One of them being this idea that Yemenis were more docile or quote unquote easier to control, particularly at a time when Mexican and Filipino workers were starting to, you know, resist and organize with unions. And so growers were interested in employing Yemenis. But of course, as we know, that this idea that Yemenis were docile was not true. And so Yemenis were coming to the U.S. and to California for many reasons, mainly because of political changes that were happening in Yemen in 1968. North Yemenis overthrew the monarchy and became the Republic of Yemen. Meanwhile, in South Yemen, efforts were made to decolonize the city of Aden, which had been colonized by the British. And so in 1967, South Yemen became the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. And so with these political changes and, of course, war, right, happening in North and South Yemen, there was this decline in economic opportunities. And so many Yemenis, mainly of them young men, like my father, started migrating for labor throughout the world, including the U.S. in the 1960s and 1970s. And the 1965 Immigration Act sort of allowed for more Yemenis to come into the U.S.
And so those stories, they led you to look more deeply into the role the UFW played in the lives of Yemeni farm workers. And you found that the UFW's emphasis on social justice was appealing to them. You write that the inclusion of Yemenis in the UFW's official narrative, however, is limited. One story that is more well known is the death of Nagi Defala, a 24-year-old immigrant and UFW organizer who was killed during a protest when a picket captain was arrested in Lamont, California. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, so for those familiar with the UFW, the death of Nagi Defala really looms large, right? And so in August of 1973, the UFW was participating in a strike with upcoming union contracts. And so during that strike, a group of strikers, Nagi among, included in them, were standing outside of a cafe in Lamont when a deputy sheriff arrived to arrest picket captain by the name of Frank Quintana. And Nagi was amongst several workers who had tried to protest this arrest. And upon protesting of the arrest, the sheriff began harassing Nagi. And as Nagi attempted to run away, the sheriff allegedly swung a metal flashlight at his head. And so while police harassment was common for many farm workers in the area, the death of Nagi was really shocking. And deeply impacted the trajectory of the UFW, which my research sort of demonstrates.
Right. And you write that thousands of Mexican, Filipino, and mm-hmm. Yemeni mourners gathered at his funeral. But it turns out that multicultural movements can get pretty complicated.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened at the funeral.
Yeah, exactly. So on August 17, 1973, I mean, over 7,000 farm workers gathered for Nagi's funeral march. And so one of the things that's often not talked about in terms of the history of Nagi's death is that during the funeral march, Yemeni workers carried a large portrait of the late Egyptian president Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was a, you know, ardent leader of anti-colonial Arab nationalism. And so I think, the inclusion of Nasser's portrait really set into place a series of events that demonstrated the ways in which solidarities can be complicated, right? And movements, including multiple communities, can be challenging to navigate.
Yes, and you said that the portrait of Nasser at the funeral, it kind of ended up threatening the UFW's relationship with the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm, correct. So one of the consequences that we see happening after Nagi's funeral march, and that I was able to find during my research in the archives, in, you know, dozens of letters that were sent to Chavez and the UFW following the march was, you know, a complete outrage of the inclusion of Nasser's portrait, including disappointment from leaders in the AFL-CIO and with the UFW was an affiliate, which sort of elevated the UFW to this national level. And so the threatening of that relationship really pushed the UFW to consider these global questions of Arab nationalism, and specifically the question of Palestine, in which Nasser was a supporter of, that the UFW otherwise would not have had to come face to face with.
And the UFW was fine with Yemenis carrying the portrait. That wasn't that wasn't the problem. It was just that afterwards there was this reaction that probably wasn't expected. So what is your takeaway from all this research? What lessons can be learned about the history of Yemenis working in the Valley? What do you think they gave to the UFW that perhaps isn't known?
Well, I think one of the takeaways is something historians of social justice movements have long demonstrated, which is that solidarities are complicated and difficult to maintain, right? And I think the history of Yemenis working in the Valley specifically is a reminder that local politics here in the Central Valley are not separate from global politics, as demonstrated by the turn towards Arab nationalism, right, in this history of Yemenis and the UFW. And I think what Yemenis brought to the UFW was this idea of thinking about social justice in larger global ways. And to this day, Nagy is considered a martyr of the UFW, and they've done, you know, tremendous work to commemorate his life and honor the service that he did for the UFW. And Nagy's also a leader in the Yemeni American community, and there have been, you know, several events celebrating his life as well in the past few years.
And you're currently working on a book that includes much of what we've been talking about today. How is that going?
Yeah, so I'm currently finishing my dissertation. I'll be defending next month and graduating in May with my PhD. But I hope to turn this dissertation into a book project in which one of the chapters will explore the history of Yemenis in the Central Valley and their involvement in the UFW. And I hope to think about the diaspora in larger ways, and how Yemeni workers throughout the 20th century highlighted the connections between local challenges in the diaspora with global politics of empire. And of course, the Central Valley is a huge component to that history.
Well, Nima, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Following the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, African Americans gained access to professional and educational opportunities never before available. However, coverage of those success stories was largely ignored by traditional media outlets. That's why six young friends in Fresno set out to create Grapevine Magazine, a publication that from 1969 to 1982 shared the life and style of prominent African Americans in the Valley. An exhibition at the Henry Madden Library at Fresno State honors the magazine. I paid it a visit and spoke to the dean of the library, Del Hornbuckle. She spoke about the vision that Frank Johnson and the other founders had for the magazine. But first, we talked about how the exhibition got started. Tell me about how you came to know about this magazine.
Well, I'd been interested in some big splash for Black History Month about a year ago. And I've been on board since 2017, and we just kind of had book displays and no real events, no real exhibitions or anything. And I just happened to be watching the evening news. I don't know the affiliate, but definitely CBS. And Anthony Bailey, who's the weather guy, has a Black History Month segment that I guess he does once a week, Hidden Valley Hidden History. I think I'm saying that correctly. And lo and behold, it was a Grapevine magazine and Dr. Marius, who had illustrations that were also in the Grapevine magazine. And that was absolutely it. I was thrilled just by the segment and learning about the Johnson family, the founding editors, and the Grapevine magazine. And I'm from Dallas, Texas. And so it hit home for me because we had a similar kind of magazine and publication. Basically, that was kind of the power of Black media. For me, it was the Dallas Weekly, the Dallas Post Tribune, and the very same thing. It was like our Jet magazine in Dallas, Texas, highlighting Black excellence, Black first in the community, community events that the mainstream media would have never picked up in my community. So it really kind of resonated for me. So I reached out to Frank, and it was about 6 to 8 months before we were able to really connect. And in addition to having an exhibition and bringing the Grapevine to the Henry Madden Library, I was excited about the possibility of acquiring the collection for our special collections and our permanent collection so that it's available, preserved, and archived for future generations. So we've made all of that happen. So this is a real thrill for me.
Speak to the importance of Black media.
It's a powerful tool. I mean, it really kind of was a segment, and I guess, I'm aging myself here, but I think at that point we're talking about, and I can speak from my childhood growing up in Dallas, Texas, it was the time of busing, the time of desegregation. And when you talk about mainstream media, It typically, the stories that you were hearing, you were kind of Black pathology, all of the issues, all of the bad stuff. But you had this whole other outlet that was really focused on all of the wonderful events, the entertainment, the things happening in the Black community that just was not covered in mainstream media. And when we talk about, I think you may remember in the media, the selling of the archives of Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine. That was the power. Every Black household that I grew up with had a subscription to Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine for that very same reason. We learned about events happening in our community, our celebrities, all of that excellence that you would not get in mainstream media. And that was the power of that, to show us and tell our stories, and that kind of representation that you, again, wouldn't get in the mainstream media.
Is there a particular part of this exhibition that is particularly impactful to you?
I think what's impactful, I'm learning about all the families and in the Central Valley. There are all of these kind of core families that have kind of fanned out somewhere in the school system, well-known figures in the community at the TV stations. And we're talking about from the late 60s on. So I'm learning so much about this really dynamic community that I would have never known anything about. And that's the other important thing about this exhibition. I think it's sort of bringing to light this community that really had no real underscore or wasn't highlighted at Fresno State. And even if you look at some of the magazines, some of the first employees and some of the first athletes here on campus, it's really a first.
And what has the feedback been?
Very positive. Obviously, this is a real anchor for our African-American students to really be excited about their history here in the Central Valley. But it's been exciting for all students, and we've had a great turnout. I think just having the doors open and having this here, students hanging out and just walking through the exhibition, has been really exciting. Just, and I've kind of stepped through and stood in the back just to look at the students looking at the exhibition. So it's been a great turnout so far.
The issue of representation of African Americans in the media was a problem in the 60s when this magazine was first started. It continues to be an issue today. I'm wondering, what is your hope for the impact of this exhibition on students and what they may choose to do as a result of being exposed to it?
Always having an opportunity to tell your story. I think that's the most important takeaway for me, is that you have these founding people who saw a need to tell stories, to tell the stories in their own voice. When you look at the magazine, you've got recipes that come from the South. So you're kind of talking about a lineage that came from the South to the Central Valley, which is just fascinating to me. The best dressed, and if you look, for example, I keep referencing Jet Magazine, you've got a best dressed person. It's the same thing that I saw in Jet Magazine, to show excellence. Representation really matters. And I hope that students in particular take that away, that you can always sort of find a venue for that, that really expresses your voice and gives you voice and representation.
Thank you so much, Dean Hornbuckle. We really appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure.
During my visit to the Grapevine Magazine exhibition, I also spoke with one of the magazine's founders, Cleo Johnson. I asked him what they set out to achieve with the magazine.
We mainly wanted to show what was going on in West Fresno with the citizens. The local TV stations and newspapers, about the only time they would do anything on the West Fresno community, which was mainly minorities, was of a negative point of view. And so we wanted to show exactly the people that lived in West Fresno, from little kids in preschool all the way up to college students and those that are starting their professions, are been active in the community trying to promote minority interests.
Describe this exhibition. What will people find when they come to see it?
Well, when they come, I hope they see what I saw, that there was a lot of things going on in the community. They will see all of the positive aspects of the community. I want to say police chief in Fresno was African-American. The fire chief at one time was African-American. One of the founders of the magazine, Jim Aldridge, was the city manager of Fresno. But they'll see that once opportunities are given to minorities, that started in about 1960, around that time, they had opportunities to get employment in places they'd never been able to get employment.
Tell me one of your favorite issues.
Okay, that would be the issue that we featured my father and his history. His history of moving from Arkansas to California. My mom and my dad wanted to get away from the racial atmosphere, but they wanted to get to California, and we did a three-page story on his history.
And what did you think when you found out that Fresno State wanted to put on this exhibition?
Excited. 50 years later, this is the most major thing that got me excited enough to come out of retirement of 20 years to do a little research on what we did and how we did it. I don't know. But Fresno State is great. Seeing how they've I don't have words for it.
Well, Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for sharing your history and this story with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your help.
The Grapevine Magazine exhibition is on the third floor of the Madden Library at Fresno State. It is free to the public and open through March 30th. And now it's time for the weekend. For those familiar with the Tower District tradition, the first two weekends in March are about to be busy with performers and attendees of the annual Rogue Festival. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke with Donald Monroe, who covers art and culture in the San Joaquin Valley, on his website, The Monroe Review, to get a taste of what the festival will offer this year.
Hi, Donald. Thanks for being with us.
It is great to be here, as always.
So as we know, the Rogue Festival is an arts festival. Some call it a fringe fest. And FYI, Valley Public Radio is a media sponsor. But throughout these next two weekends, there are these venues in the Tower District, and performers come and set up a show that's usually 45 minutes to an hour of varying content, some music, some drama or comedy. And so to start, for those who maybe haven't heard of the Rogue Festival before or have not been out there, can you give us a sense of what advice you might give those first timers?
Well, I would tell people not to worry too much about planning ahead. What you can do is get a copy of the Rogue program, and the easiest way to do that is just go to the Rogue website and download the PDF. And it has a list of all the venues. It has a list of the schedules for each day. And what I find is most helpful is I figure out what my time possibilities are. So it's like, well, maybe I want to go Saturday night from 8 to 11 p.m. And then I just figure out what is playing at that time. Then I take the program and I just start looking things up. And like you said, there is a variety. You can find everything. It's like a supermarket of entertainment.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, for those who maybe don't frequent the Tower District very much, we should note the venues are really close together. So you could say park in one spot and then, you know, just walk from venue to venue, as you said, from like 8 to 11 in between shows. And then so for those who have been to the festival before, what do you think this year is offering that's a little different from the past?
Well, the way the Rogue is set up is it includes both performers who come from out of town and sometimes even from out of the country. And then we've got a good mix of local performers, and they actually try to kind of make it that way. So half and half. And so a lot of the times it's just a totally new slate. Now, there are always going to be some veterans who are doing their thing.
And you mean like performers who have been there
people
before
who,
and you know what
people
to expect.
Who have done it just over and over again. I mean, one of those is Victor DeRoche, who is known for the band Boxcar Figaro, but I believe this will be his 17th Rogue show.
Wow.
And he puts on a musical act in which he kind of interacts with the audience and sort of storytelling, sort of singing. And he's always changing his show. So he'll change his show every year. If you start looking through the program, you will notice familiar actor names from the community. So if you're a Good Company Players fan, you will notice some of your favorite stars, I guess you could say. There is a show, and I'm not even really sure how to pronounce this because it isn't really a word, but it's called Late Night Covfefe.
I read that one and immediately
Which
laughed.
Is a word that was coined by President Trump. And so
in a tweet, I said.
In a tweet, and hence we don't really know how to pronounce it. But, you know, that's got folks like Noel Adams, Britt Monaghan, Karen Johnson, Janice Noga. All these are names are familiar. So I would say that the best strategy is to pick some stuff you know and then some stuff that you just take a chance on.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the benefits, too, is because not all of the acts are familiar. If you go through the website, they really recommend people who do go to a show or multiple shows leave reviews to kind of give other folks an idea of like what you liked, what you disliked, and also to help the performers, you know, construct some feedback for their own shows. And this year is the 19th annual Rogue Festival. You mentioned one performer has done this 17 times, so over the years, a lot of different performances. But what kind of growth have you seen with this event, or even how has it changed? I mean, we know it changes year to year with performers, but just, I guess, with the way it's organized and kind of the experience they offer, I don't know, how has it changed for you?
I think one change is that it has just become a tradition. And so anytime you have a tradition, there are almost sort of rituals that unfold. We always have our people who are the true diehard Rogue fans who will start on that first Friday and go to as many shows as possible. So I have talked to people who have gone to 20, 30 shows over the course of those two weekends. There are certain venues that have remained a constant at the Rogue for ever and always. Vinnie Vidi Vici is one of them. But there are also new venues that pop up every time. And so there is a new venue that is right next to Goldstein's in the Tower, which I think the full name is Goldstein's
Mortuary and Delicatessen.
Mm-hmm. So they're putting a tent up there. I think that'll be a really interesting venue because you will have access to the libations at Goldstein's, and also you get, you know, can enjoy a show there. So there's new stuff, there's old stuff, but it is sort of comforting that just some things at the Rogue never change. You see the same people tend to be walking around.
And as someone who's gone, do you have certain rituals or like traditions for going yourself? Like, do you always go the first Saturday or anything like that?
I do go the first weekend. I think of the first weekenders are kind of the trailblazers because, like you say, people leave a lot of reviews and there's word of mouth that gets out. But I think it's fun to just take a chance, go and see things you don't know what you're going to get. And sometimes what happens is a show will get a lot of buzz. It'll get a lot, you know, good reviews, word of mouth, and then it's almost impossible to get a ticket for the second weekend. So I like to be that guy who is there at the first weekend, like trying to figure out what is going to be popular the second weekend.
And so going into the weekend, what is right now, if anything, do you have like an immediate must-see list built out yet?
So what I do sometimes is I just take a look at the program and I see where these performers have been, mm-hmm. because some of them really have extensive background. Sometimes I, and by background, I mean they have performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, they go to Australia, they travel all over the country. So each entry in the catalog lists the hometown. And so sometimes I just kind of go off that. Now, there's a couple of shows that intrigue me just for the titles. One show is called A One-Man Sci-Fi Climate Change Tragicomedy. And the full, it's, so it's Man Cave, colon, A One-Man Sci-Fi Climate Change Tragicomedy. I think the title says it all, right? It's like, it almost is begging you to go see that one. I am always interested to see one-person shows that are really well-crafted, directed, edited. And so it's always a treat to be able to see these performers do their thing. So I will also look for those kinds of shows.
Have you gone to shows that have potentially like launched someone into, you know, as well known as you can be in Fresno?
So this is an example of somebody who came to the Rogue many years ago and for a number of years and then became very famous. And so like
Fresno famous or beyond Fresno
famous? No, like off Broadway.
Ah.
Kind of established his career. So you could say that you had seen, so his name's Baba Brinkman, and he did a rap show. He rapped the Canterbury Tales is what he debuted at Rogue.
So is that like rapping on stage before Lin-Manuel Miranda made it cool?
I would say, yeah, because this had to be like at the beginning of the Rogue. He was
so like
big,
18 years ago-ish. Wow.
Very much so. And so he has actually tried out a lot of his shows here at the Rogue. So that's kind of fun. As far as locally, I would say more that it is well-known actors who kind of dabble in this.
Right, like trying, maybe they're usually in staged dramas or musicals and they're trying like comedy or you know, sketch performing or something.
Right. Or they decide to do a one-person show. There's a pretty well-known, there's like a series that's called Flower Tome Companion. And so they're calling this the final episode. I think it's their fourth installment, but it is an old-fashioned radio show. And it is filled with local humor, you know, Tower District references left and right. Some really good actors, again, people you would recognize from local community theater. And they just have a lot of fun with the sound effects and, you know, doing this kind of silly old time radio type of thing. I'm curious because they do say it's the final episode. I'll believe it when I see it. But.
Awesome. Well, for those who are in the Fresno area, specifically in the Tower District, the Rogue Festival runs March 6th through the 14th. Information is at fresnoroguefestival.com. Donald Monroe, thanks for talking to us about this. We'll look out for your work on your website at monroereview.com, Monroe spelled M-U-N-R-O. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Staniel, Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Mari Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Veronica Garibay and Phoebe Seton, 2020 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about their work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.